Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals sitting at Texas A&M University School of Law. We are very happy to be here today. I would like to introduce our clerks and our staff that we have. We have our clerk, Bonnie Alexander, and Karen Brown, and our bailiff, Ron Embry, as well as staff attorney, Jonathan Cohn. And I think we also have a clerk with us, Brian Steinacher. Is he here with here? Intern? Brian Steinacher. There we go. All right, so we're glad he's here. And your panel today is to my right, Justice Bill Meyer. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel, and I am Sue Walker. We have two cases on our docket this morning for oral submission. And so if counsel has announced the time they would like to argue, and you all are familiar with how the timing system is going to work here today, then we'll have our clerk call the first case.
The court will now call the Dallas Morning News et al. Versus Lewis Hall and Richard Hall et al. And may it please the court, Mr. Thomas Leatherberry to argue for the appellants, and Mr. John Shaw to argue for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Tom Leatherberry on behalf of the appellants, the Dallas Morning News, and its courts reporter, Kevin Krause. Based on a federal search warrant issued to Department of Defense criminal investigators, a search warrant that listed five federal criminal statutes under investigation, including healthcare fraud and anti-kickback laws, and a search warrant that named appellees twice as persons whose communications it was specifically looking for, and also among several ongoing lawsuits to which appellees were parties, Mr. Krause wrote and the Dallas Morning News published the articles that appellees claim constitute defamation. The trial court erred in denying the appellant's motion to dismiss under the Texas Citizens Participation Act, Texas's anti-SLAPP statute. It's undisputed that appellants met their burden under the first prong of the statute. They proved by a preponderance of the evidence that each article is subject to the act, the protections of the act, but the appellees failed to introduce clear and specific evidence of falsity, which was their burden, of course, as a matter of constitutional law. This failure warrants reversal and dismissal of appellees' claims in two ways. First, under general defamation law, falsity is an essential element of the appellees' defamation claims, because this speech concerns a matter of public concern. And that's, again, a constitutional rule of law. The second way is clear and specific evidence of falsity was required to overcome the statutory judicial privileges that appellants established, the judicial proceedings privilege, and the third-party allegation privilege, our newest privilege under the Texas defamation statute. Appellees did not offer clear and specific evidence of falsity through their conclusory hearsay and speculative affidavits of Mr. Richard Hall, Mr. Mike Highschool, and others, to which appellants objected and which objections were overruled. They did not offer clear and specific evidence of falsity through their unusual post-hearing late September filing, which they styled an advisory, and which was admittedly not based on proof. In fact, at the September hearing on the motion to dismiss, appellees' counsel conceded that the federal search warrant, which had been produced in its entirety by that time and authenticated by Mr. Halsey, the source of Mr. Krause, conceded that it was authentic and had been served on Mr. Halsey. And in the advisory that appellees filed in late September before the court ruled, just the day before the court ruled, denying the motion to dismiss, appellees appeared to concede that there was an investigation, at least to the extent that the search warrant was issued on a showing of probable cause to the Department of Defense investigators and signed by Judge Ramirez, And, but they claimed at that point that even though there was an investigation, as reported by the Dallas Morning News, it was a sham. Of course, now that conspiracy sham theory has been abandoned by the appellees, and they're back to their July 2016 position, which was the search warrant might have been fabricated, it didn't exist, it was just excerpts rather than the full search warrant, ignoring really the record in the case. So because of appellee's failure to introduce clear and specific evidence of falsity, appellant's motion to dismiss should have been granted, judgment rendered for the appellants on the defamation claims, on all claims, because that's the sole claims that are in the case, and the case remanded for consideration of the appellant's request for attorney's fees. Let me turn first to a principal issue in the case, falsity, and the gist of the articles. And actually, you take each article individually and look at its gist, but we can group them together, and there's some common themes. As the court knows, the gist of an article is the central meaning that the hypothetical, ordinary, and reasonable reader would take from the article. And we cited to the court, of course, Chief Justice Heck's 2016 opinion in the Toledo case, and particularly footnote 29, where he discusses gist and what a ordinary, hypothetical, reasonable reader would understand from the article. The gist should be determined, as I said, from each article, taking the article as a whole and not isolating or not isolating specific statements or looking at them individually, but the article as a whole. The gist of most of the articles really contains two prongs. The gist of most of the articles was that appellees are under federal investigation and are also involved in several very contentious lawsuits about their business practices, both as plaintiffs and usually as plaintiffs, sometimes as defendants. So there are two prongs of the gist. The remaining articles, most of the articles contain both prongs of the gist. Some of the articles simply contain the gist about being under investigation and did not report on the lawsuits. So depending on the article at issue, and there are several, appellees complained about one or two categories of statements. Statements about being under investigation and statements that third parties were making against them as allegations in the civil lawsuits on which Mr. Krause reported. So I want to discuss each prong of the gist, each category of statements separately, and then turn, if I have time, and if not, I'll do it in rebuttal, to the claim of creation of falsity by juxtaposition of facts and statements in a particular article. So the falsity under investigation of the under investigation statements deserves special scrutiny because, as I said, both general defamation law and the judicial or official proceedings privilege applies here. And as the court well knows from its jurisprudence, reporters and media defendants get quite a bit of latitude in reporting on allegations, including investigations and civil lawsuits. Appellee's argument, as I said, has come full circle about being under investigation. And this has been the primary focus of the lawsuit and appellee's complaints about the articles at issue. At first, they denied the existence of any investigation, and those were in the filings in July. At the July hearing on the motion for discovery, appellees claimed that the search warrant excerpt, which had been produced and authenticated by Mr. Krause, a two-page excerpt of the entire search warrant, was fabricated or could have been fabricated. I think one of the quotes or paraphrases was, "There's no way it exists." So the trial court, Judge Taus,
authenticated by Mr. Krause or Mr. Halsey?
At first, the two-page excerpt was authenticated as what Mr. Krause received from Mr. Halsey. And then, Your Honor, right to that question, At the July hearing, Judge Towson granted limited discovery, and the plaintiffs or appellees took advantage of that discovery. They served Mr. Halsey with a subpoena, Deuces Tecum, and asked him to produce an entire copy of the search warrant. Mr. Halsey did so and filed it with an affidavit or in the court. That's at Clerk's Record 676 through 701. And so the entire search warrant is before the court and part of the record.
Mr. Leatherwood, what you're asking us to do is to consider what was produced months after the articles were written in the form of a full affidavit as opposed to the two pages Mr. Krause had whenever he wrote the articles.
Well, Your Honor, the full search warrant was produced after the articles. That's for sure. Our position is that the articles, particularly the February and March articles that we're discussing, were true and substantially true and accurate reports of judicial proceedings just based on those two pages.
And the whole point of it is when you look at the affidavit, I mean, not the affidavit, we never saw an affidavit.
That's correct. And
so
the proceeding still remains under seal.
The document that's called a sealed United States District Court in the matter of the search of and in the name of the premises at 4056 Lovers Lane. That's what that page and the second page that is kind of folded over is what Mr. Krause had when he was writing about a federal investigation.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's what the record shows.
Yes. And in terms of the subpoena itself,
yes,
there's not any accusations in the subpoena as regards any of the plaintiffs.
Your Honor, the articles are true based on a plain reading of the excerpts or the search warrant because in the search warrant, even in the two excerpts, it specifically names the plaintiffs as individuals whose communications are being sought under the search warrant. And it talks about various subjects covered by the anti-kickback laws that that they are searching for in as part of the execution of this search warrant.
But it doesn't tie any particular causes of action or any particular violations to the plaintiffs.
I think a plain reading of the statute is that they were under investigation for possible violations of the statutes, including the statutes that are listed in the two-page excerpt, which include the anti-kickback laws. And Your Honors, at the September hearing, if I can just finish the chronology, the plaintiffs acknowledged, the appellees acknowledged and conceded in Reporter's Record 3 at 12 and 13 that the search warrant was authentic and it was served on Mr. Halsey. I think for purposes of truth, as I said, either with the excerpts or with the entire search warrant, I think the court is entitled to look at the entire search warrant to determine the truth of the reporting. State of mind is not an issue here. What Mr. Krause knew and what he saw is not a contested issue, just truth. And I think under those circumstances, the court can look at the entire search warrant, although it need not. And then in the advisory that was filed, it's really a unique filing. I'm sure the court has read it. The plaintiffs reaffirmed that the search warrant was authentic, and there was an investigation, but they claimed it was a sham. And also, Your Honor, and now they're back to their July position, overlooking the fact that the entire search warrant is part of the record and the concessions made in September and in the advisory.
Mr. Leatherberry,
yes, sir.
Let me ask you.
Yes, sir.
Let's talk in terms of your position. And I've read everything in the record, all of your presentations to the trial court. I didn't read the entire 400 pages that your co-counsel put in the record.
Yes, sir.
But I do want to understand it's your position that when you're looking at the anti-slap statute, we're looking at all of these articles together, aren't we?
No, Your Honor.
That's what I think. It's where I'm understanding you differ from what I read the case law to say. You're wanting to pull them apart and look at each individual publication.
Yes, Your Honor.
Either a email, I mean, excuse me, either a on-site presentation or a published in the, in the hard paper.
Right.
And what it appears to me that the case law says that we're looking to do is to look at all those together in terms of the information, determining whether a ordinary listener could believe that this was a fair, true, and impartial account.
Right. And Your Honor, I understand the court's question because there is an outlier case recently from Corpus Christi, and I can't remember the name of the plaintiff in that, but it's against one of the Scripps papers against the Caller Times, I believe. And in that case, the court looked at a series of articles about a Chamber of Commerce official, as I believe. And our position is that's completely wrong, and it violates years of Texas law where each article is judged within its own four corners, because you can't assume that an ordinary reasonable reader is going to read the whole series of 10 or 11 articles, how many there are.
Well, you hyperlink previous articles to a subsequent article, how can you not consider those together?
Oh, no, I agree with that, Justice Gabriel. Absolutely. I agree that you construe each article with its in its own four corners, and that Corpus Christi case is up on petition for review, and that's issue number one, you know, front and center, is whether the court erred in considering the entire series of articles rather than each article individually. But, Justice Gabriel, I think you're exactly right. I think when you hyperlink, as some of these articles do, back to the February 5th article, the initial article, I think you are entitled to take into account the content in the February 5th article as a reasonable, ordinary, hypothetical reader would do. So we're not taking the position that hyperlinks are off limits. We're definitely on the same page with the court on that position. So let me talk about the evidence of falsity that I know. Okay, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I thought that was two. I guess my hearing is abandoning me. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll see you in rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel, John Shaw for the appellees in this case. I want to touch first on, which again, counsel before me did, the standard upon which the burden of proof which we are supposed to carry in this case. And that's to present clear and specific evidence for a prima facie case on each essential element of our claim. A claim's defamation. The Supreme Court recently said in N. Ray Lipsky that in a defamation case that implicates the Texas Citizen Participation Act, pleadings and evidence that establish the facts of when, where, and what was said, the defamatory nature of the statements, and how they harm the plaintiff should be sufficient to carry to defeat a motion to dismiss. There's no dispute about when, where, and what was said. There's a series of articles stretching for about approximately 45 days that establish all of that. There's no doubt that harm was done. I think the evidence in the record is sufficient to show clearly and specifically through the testimony of Mr. Hall related to the fact that prescriptions that were submitted to the pharmacy dropped off dramatically beginning and ending in that time span, including letters from other pharmacies and pharmacy benefit managers citing possible violations of their contracts related to the allegations that could only have been found in one place, and that was the articles published by the Dallas Morning News. Testimony from doctors that upon reading these articles, whether or not that is considered as in conjunction with whether the statements are defamatory, but these doctors, which relied heavily on filling prescriptions at R-Express, simply stopped writing them.
So is it your position that you did or did not have to prove falsity by clear and specific evidence at the motion to dismiss stage?
I certainly had to prove falsity. I'm just trying to cover the basis of the other elements briefly because that was our burden under the statute, and I think we carried it. As to falsity, the court just touched on the question of the gist of the articles and whether that gist is determined by an article in isolation or the series of articles as they were written. I think the evidence is clear that, and I also want to touch on one other point, is that we have to prove the falsity of the articles, but by virtue of proving that falsity, we essentially also overcome, I think, the burden as it relates to defending against any possible defenses, which are truth and privilege. So returning back to falsity, I mean, the gist of these articles can really be summed up best, I think, by reference to the article published on February 9th, the one the court referenced as hyperlinked back. And that article simply stated that one hyperlinked passage references our Express Pharmacy of Fort Worth is currently being investigated for possible violations of federal law by the Department of Defense due to its use of TRICARE money. Nowhere in the evidence or the matters that Mr. Krause and the Dallas Morning News had before them was any reference ever made to TRICARE, was any reference ever made to our to appellees being under investigation for use of TRICARE money or otherwise committing any other form of criminal federal health care fraud. Juxtaposing that statement, going back to the February 5th article, you have statements picked, I think, very selectively after a view of the record, referencing allegations made in a civil lawsuit that has nothing to do with violation of federal criminal laws, to allegations of from a disgruntled accountant that has claimed without support that they have been paying kickbacks to doctors. The falsity related to the February 9th statement is simply, I mean, it cannot be true because our Express Pharmacy had not even filled a TRICARE prescription since it was reorganized as our Express in 2013. How could they violate?
One of their responses to that is that the statute of limitations hadn't run, so you could go back prior to 2013, correct?
The other evidence in the record is that the predecessor, the Legacy Pharmacy, which was the medicine store pharmacy, had never made an application for, or received money related to any Medicare, Medicaid, or other state or federally funded health care, or prescription or health care plan. I mean, there's simply no evidence. The only evidence in the record is that they didn't take money from the government because they didn't fill prescriptions for the government. And a statement.
Didn't you concede that before 2013 that they did accept TRICARE money? Wasn't that in your briefing?
I don't recall that being in the brief. I believe the affidavits and the statements were, the statement was that they never received TRICARE money prior to 2013. I don't know if there was an affirmative recitation that they did, or after 2013, I don't believe there was an affirmative recitation that they in fact did. And if, I do know that the affidavit evidence stated that the predecessor did not, however, accept money from any other state or federally funded health care plan. But I think that it's, again, that it is telling about the gist of the articles is that, I mean, the author himself ties all of this back to TRICARE fraud. And I just don't think that there was no evidence to suggest that. Not even the search warrant itself, which the search warrant was not two physical pieces of paper. The search warrant received by Mr. Krause was two cell phone pictures of two pieces of paper that he received from a former, source or informant. Who has a checkered history of being involved in his own federal investigations ranging from the SEC, which he is currently being investigated for securities fraud. I don't think that under the circumstances that would have been sufficient to be a substantially true basis for reporting that the appellees were under investigation essentially for TRICARE fraud, which is what is repeated continuously throughout the article.
Ms. Shaw, help me with a little bit.
Sure.
With what is, from your client's position, the duty of the reporting press, internet, or paper, to inquire and ascertain facts before writing an article that pertains to a federal activity where some people are being accused of violating the law?
Well, I think in this instance, my clients were contacted prior to the articles being written. And at no point in time was any reference ever made or even any suggestion or attempt made to ask the appellees about the nature of the article or really what was going to be written, other than one vague, I believe, statement that asked whether or not they were aware of the general investigations involving compounding pharmacies across the United States and some that had started in the North Texas area.
And so when we're reviewing what is a fair, true, and impartial account, would you ascribe to the theory that the reporter, person writing the material, is obligated to do more than look at two pages of a subpoena to determine or come to the conclusion that a federal investigation was underway as to your clients?
I think if they had been given proper documentation from a recognized or authoritative source, I think that's fair, and I would say that's a fair statement. But in this instance, it goes beyond merely just the reference to the two pictures of two pages of a search warrant received by somebody who at the time had no relation to and still has no relation to our clients. But it is also juxtaposing that situation by taking very specific allegations from other litigation that plaintiffs are involved in that were all at core, they're simply business disputes. One was a malpractice case against an accountant. The other was a breach of contract case involving a pharmacy benefits manager. And pulling out specifically
before
the allegations.
Before you move on to that, I just need one other thing cleared up for me, if you could, please. We heard in appellant's argument that the state of mind of the person who wrote the article at the time when he only had two pages is not what we're looking at. We're looking at whether it was false, and we can consider the entire record. Do you agree with that?
I do not necessarily agree that we can consider the entire record as related to receiving a full search warrant months after the fact that wasn't actually and truly authenticated until days before the hearing when it was the Dallas Morning News, the appellants who filed an affidavit from Mr. Halsey that they alleged was the authenticating affidavit. Originally, we simply received a search warrant in, I believe, late June or late July from Mr. Halsey simply as the document.
But if the issue is falsity, then that's the issue. Do you have any case law to support your position that we're supposed to look at what he had on the date that he wrote the article and stop there?
I do not, but I still think the point of, I mean, I still, when considering substantial truth, we're looking at the entirety of the articles. I mean, each one pieced together and the allegations as a whole. I think arguably looking at each one of these, allegations as being non-defamatory or substantially true from the perspective, say, of the judicial proceedings privilege, of if they pulled an allegation out of a lawsuit pleading in isolation, sure, that would be technically privileged by itself. But that, I don't think the judicial proceedings privilege or official proceeding privilege or literal truth as a defense disposes of or ignores the substantial truth test, which is whether or not the articles as a whole were more damaging to the plaintiff as a truthful article would have been. I mean, you can't take a series of true statements and put them together in such a way as to convey a defamatory meaning.
Mr. Shaw, Mr. Leatherberry was talking about decades of case law. Well, the anti-SLAPP Act's not really decades old. And we're really looking at the standards under the Anti-SLAPP Act, not the question of what has been the precedent on the required proof in a defamation case, aren't we?
I think you have to look at them within, I mean, they overlap, but again, as the Supreme Court said in Lipsky, it's not necessarily that we're here to prove the defamation case. I mean, that is what we are hoping the court will allow us to do after, you know, the chance to actually conduct discovery and put this case in front of a court. And if it were to be determined on summary judgment, so be it. But at least it will be determined on the facts in a fully developed matter. I think on the status of the record, I think we've carried our burden establishing the defamatory nature of the statements. Certainly, as it is in the case of if these are considered statements accusing appellees of crimes, or in the instance that they are certainly damaging the appellees in their trade or business or profession, they would qualify as defamation per se, simply based on the record as is. To the extent they would need to be defamation per quad, I think we have established harm in the manner required for us and set out by the court.
Business went from $15 million to zero?
Approximately, I think it may have actually been about 25 total.
Excuse me.
But I think that...
One other area, I'm sorry, yes, that I would yes, really ma'am. Like to ask you a question about, and that is, they also appealed the trial court's rulings on their objections, and in your response, there wasn't a lot of response. If the trial court erred in ruling on their objections, that in fact could affect the final outcome of this case. So what is your position on the trial court's rulings?
I think to the extent of the specific paragraphs and provisions objected to in the various affidavits, as stated in the briefing, I think certainly all of them go to the element of damages, establishing the harm that was caused.
Mr. High School?
Mr. High School, I think they're alleging in their case that the search warrant says what it says, and that's enough. I can't think of any other way to challenge that but to have someone that is far more skilled in the area of criminal law than I can tell you that I'm not explain to us what the meaning of a search warrant is in the context of a healthcare fraud investigation. As someone, you know, experienced in that matter as a longtime assistant U.S. attorney in prosecuting them. Thank you.
Was he challenged as an expert in your judgment?
I don't think he was challenged as an expert necessarily. I think it was simply mostly objections to conclusory and hearsay basis.
What other piece of, before you sit down, sure. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, sir.
In all of the documentation that was presented to the trial court, what is there that connects, and I'm not talking about the allegations and pleadings of the supposed CPA or in dispute with the manager, the medicine, I'm just talking about documents, anything other than those statements pulled out of lawsuits. What other piece of evidence was there that there was a federal investigation?
None other than the two pages from the search warrant.
All right, thank you, sir.
Ms. Brown, will you add 1 minute
to
Mr.
Leatherberry's
time?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Meyer, we did not challenge Mr. High School's qualifications, but we did challenge the admissibility of his opinion. It wasn't the proper subject of expert opinion. His own affidavit shows that. And there was too big an analytical gap between what he looked at and the facts in the record and his opinion about the status of the investigation
and
incidental collection.
His testimony is stricken.
Yes, sir.
I'm still looking for any evidence other than these two pages in this telephone copied part of a subpoena that showed there was a federal investigation into these people. I'm not talking about, understand there's a huge investigation involving many, many other entities, people, individuals, but as far as these plaintiffs, parties,
right.
and that you're looking to have their lawsuit cut short under the Annis slap. What evidence is there, any piece of paper, that ties them to further investigation by a federal governmental agency?
Your Honor, it's the search warrant, and it's the plain language of the search warrant. It identifies the plaintiffs as not incidental collection, but people whose communications are being sought. It was obtained on a showing probable cause by the DOD. TRICARE is the DOD's insurance company. Any kickback allegations are described in even the two pages, and certainly more fully in the search warrant. So that's the answer to that. And in terms, Justice Meyer, of there's also a concession in the record that really hasn't been challenged. Mr. Myers was interviewed. Our client did much, much more than look at two pages before he wrote that first article. He examined the lawsuits. He talked to Mr. Hall. He talked to Mr. Myers. Mr. Myers, in the February 5th article, conceded or said, yes, we took TRICARE money. I don't know how much. And so that's all in the record that's for the court to consider. And 2013 should not matter because of the statute of limitations that Justice Gabriel brought up. Now, let me talk about the juxtaposition argument, because I've not gotten much time on the lawsuit allegations, but really the lawsuit allegations, the court knows, we don't have to establish the truth of the underlying allegations. We just have to show that the allegations were accurately reported on. And really, there's not much dispute from appellees that we accurately reported on the allegations that were there. Their complaints are we didn't report more, and that we should have gone to look at other things before we wrote the article about these lawsuits. And under Toledo, we don't have a duty to do that. As long as it's a fair, true, and impartial report of the judicial proceedings, that's sufficient. And in talking about...
I think their complaint is that you cherry-picked pieces and sentences out of different lawsuits and piece them together in a manner that was unfairly defamatory.
I understand, Your Honor, and that's exactly the best of their juxtaposition claims that we were talking about. Did we create some kind of falsity by juxtaposing statements from the lawsuit with the federal investigation and those sorts of things? The juxtaposition has to create the falsity. And there is no falsity created by the juxtapositions, and it's also privileged, because if you look at the cases that interpret the judicial proceedings privileges, we cited to the court the Maloof versus AOL case out of Dallas, where a publisher confused a civil QI-TAM Medicaid fraud case with a criminal proceeding. That was held to be privileged under the judicial proceedings statute, because no more opprobrium would have attached to saying it was a criminal proceeding versus a civil proceeding. So even if you take the gist at its worst, we strongly dispute that that's the gist, that we charged them with a crime. We did not charge them with a crime. But even if you take that, it's substantially true under the privilege and privileged as the cases have developed.
Do you have any cases applying the privilege to situations where multiple lawsuits are combined, as in this case?
You know, I'm not positive, Your Honor. I reread the Transamerica natural gas case yesterday, and it may have just been one lengthy proceeding and one trial, but something's telling me there were multiple proceedings. I could be wrong on that, but I will certainly look for that. But I think whether you take all the proceedings together or you take each individual proceeding separately, each was reported on fairly and accurately and truly. And if you look at Maloof, and if you look at the Boyd case versus Associated Press on which Maloof relies, which we argued, if you look at Transamerica Natural Gas, if you look at Basic Capital Management from the Austin Court of Appeals, the court will be reminded of how broad the latitude is that the press has to report on judicial proceedings and official proceedings. And so I think even if you take this juxtaposition gist at the most favorable for plaintiffs, the court, and we dispute again that gist, but the court would find that it's substantially true and privileged. And because of the inadequate and insufficient evidence introduced about falsity, that judgment should be granted for the defendants, for the appellants, the case remanded for consideration of attorney's fees.
I want to ask you about just one of these.
Yes, sir.
In the very first article.
Yes, sir.
On February the 5th.
Yes, sir.
This headline is.
Yes, sir.
North Texas Pharmacy and Federal Probe is accused of paying kickbacks to doctors.
Right.
Not in the subpoena.
Well, what you see, Your Honor, and perhaps this is an example of juxtaposition. They're in a federal probe that's based on the subpoena. The subpoena, even the excerpts, identifies as the investigation as being part of looking into anti-kickback laws under the healthcare statutes. If you read the article as a whole, though, Your Honor, you see that as it develops, the allegations that or accusations that are talked about kickbacks come from the lawsuit that R-Express filed against Mrs. Haynes. And that's clearly set out in the article. And the reader who would read the article as a whole would understand that that's the gist of it. And they're talking about where the allegations came from.
Her claim was that she was doing tax returns for doctors and therefore saw this.
Well, she was the accountant. She was the accountant for the company, and she filed this in her discovery responses.
I understand. I'm talking about the pleadings that were filed and this copious statement, almost just one great big paragraph that Ruth Haynes filed.
Right.
Pulling out one part of that was, I know these people paid kickbacks because I did the tax returns for the doctors.
Right. And I think so. In terms of being a true, fair, and accurate report, the article reports on R-Express sued her. They sued her for negligence or causing excessive company tax liability, is the way they put it, for malpractice. These are accusations she made in response to this claim for big monetary damages against her.
For malpractice.
For malpractice, for causing excessive company liability, I think is the way it's phrased. So, Your Honor, we can dispute, and we do dispute, that this gist is the gist of this article includes an accusation of a crime by the Dallas Morning News of R-Express. But as I said, even if the court were to agree with that gist and the juxtaposition emphasized by the plaintiffs, the court should still hold that it's substantially true and privileged under the case law like Maloof and Boyd, which interprets and applies the privilege to situations where laws carry civil and criminal liabilities. And I submit, Your Honor, that under those, there's no more substantial opprobrium to the plaintiffs with either of those interpretations.
In terms of this headline I ask you about?
Yes, sir.
Is it your belief that an ordinary listener or reader reading that headline would connect this headline to R-Express?
Yes, Your Honor, but the ordinary reader doesn't just read the headline. The ordinary reader reads the entire article. It's the hypothetical.
Reads all the entire articles, right?
No, sir. I'm still not on that page, Your Honor, and I'll try to get you something on that. But
thank you for answering my question.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor, for your time.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your argument here today and for your briefing. It's been very helpful to the court. We also appreciate you agreeing to submit your case here at Texas A&M University School of Law. Your case is now submitted, and you're free to go about your business. We are going to take a brief recess for a panel change, and we will be back in about 3 to 5 minutes.
All rise.